My name is Lorraine Richards, and I'm going to be chairing this session, and we have a number of very illustrious panel members, and I'm quite pleased to have them here. I would like to sort of start out and just give you a little bit of a background about the session and what engendered it, and very briefly do that, and then move on to letting the panel members introduce themselves. Essentially, this session came out of a project that we are working on called Educating Stewards of Public Information in the 21st Century. It's an IMLS-funded grant that's led by Helen Thibault and Cal Lee at the School of Information and Library Science at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. And they're working in conjunction with the School of Government at UNC Chapel Hill. And we have a number of goals, but I think that we can sort of succinctly put them down to two major goals. One part of what we're doing is we are revamping the joint Master of Public Administration and Master of Science in Information Science, and or Master of Public Administration and Master of Science in Library Science curriculum at the University of North Carolina. And part of the goal of that is, to prepare an initial two cohorts of students, eight students in total, who have received fellowships over the next 3 years, who are going to be prepared and ready to engage in policy within public agencies while understanding the full spectrum of records management needs in the digital environment. So we are really trying to create a program and revamp our program so that as we are moving into a more and more digital environment, we have students who are both able to understand records management aspects, concerns, issues, and who are able to engage in the policy and policy making of public organizations. In other words, we want future archivists, records managers, and public agency personnel to be able to engage in and influence policy within an increasingly digital record-keeping environment. Now, today's goals are kind of twofold. Obviously, we have a very nice panel here, and we want to understand what they have to say and what their experiences are. At the same time, there's a large number of you here today who have your own experiences in your own organizations, and you probably have questions around policy making, making sure that you've got employees who can engage in the kind of policy work that your agencies require. And so we are going to have the panel members talk about their own experiences, professionals, employers, and educators, and then they will also ask of you several key questions related to things like what kinds of skills do public sector employees need to have in order to better influence, shape, or understand the policy process in public records environments? And what problems do you face in getting employees that can do this? So without further ado, I would like to have the panel members each take about 5 minutes and introduce themselves, because if I tried to do that, I could wax gloriously for a long time, and I would like them to be able to have a chance to say what they think is most important. So maybe we can start with Shannon.
Sure. I'm Shannon Tufts. I'm actually a faculty member at the UNC School of Government. So I work with Laurie and Cal, who's in the front row, if you don't know Cal Lee. He just joined us. And Helen Thibault on this project, this ESOPI, which I can't ever say that correctly, but it's the Electronic Stewards of Public Information for the 21st Century. My area of expertise is actually around public technology. I'm the director of something called the Center for Public Technology, and I certify CIOs across the country. So we run CIO certification programs for government CIOs. Let me be clear about that. It's not the private sector. For North Carolina, a national program, a program for our K-12 population, a program for all of the state agency CIOs in North Carolina, a program in South Carolina. We just started a program in Texas. So we do a lot of certification around the area. And this is near and dear to my heart because, unfortunately, for all of you and for most of you are probably not IT people, but those IT people are really creating lots of challenges for you, probably, from a records retention standpoint. And you're creating a lot of challenges for them because you're putting all sorts of constraints on them around how this needs to happen. And they just want to run with things like social media, as we were discussing earlier. So that's who I am. I will tell you, I'm not a technologist by trade. It's sort of something that I've flown my way through and tried to become a technologist. I always tell people the best way to describe me is that I'm the living, breathing example of those who can't do teach. So if you have real technical questions, I'm probably not the person to ask, but I certainly try to advocate on behalf of public sector professionals, first of all, and then secondly, the public sector IT professionals.
Thank you, Shannon. My name is Jim Corden. I'm the state archivist in Indiana. I am the director of the Commission on Public Records. That also entails coordinating all sorts of things related to public access in Indiana. I also serve as the deputy state librarian and have the privilege of serving on both the NAGARA and COSA Council of State Archivists boards. So my experience is mostly at the state level related to electronic records and operating within the policy constraints set by the state government.
Okay, I'm Ken Thibodeau. I'm currently director of the program that I was very happy to hear the archivist talk about the other night, the National Archives Center for Advanced Systems and Technology, which is a relatively new thing. A couple things I want to say is, one, I've had considerable involvement in policy in my 35 years in the federal government, starting mainly in the 10 years I spent at the National Institutes of Health, where I worked in the Division of Management Policy, but also in quite a number of interagency groups working at the government level, including a couple that I'm currently on. One is the Interagency Working Group on Digital Data, which was established by the Committee on Science. The Committee on Science consists of the chief scientists of the cabinet agencies sitting as advisors to the president on matters of science. The committee set up the working group to establish a national framework for the management and preservation of digital data in the sciences, science writ large, to include social sciences, technology, and medicine, as well as the natural sciences, with a specific view that we need to preserve the stuff so that we can promote and enable reuse and even repurposing of the data. Within that group, I'm the co-chair of the subgroup on data management plans, and we're about to issue our second report advising agencies on what's a good way to plan for managing data so that it can be preserved and used by other users. In my second current policy role, I'm a member of the advisory board to data.gov, which is a new initiative under the administration, the Obama administration, to make it easier for the citizens to get access to public data. The role of the advisory board is basically to set the future direction for data.gov rather than in the Obama administration. The future means something beyond the next 6 months because the people responsible for it have that charge of within 6 months. Having said that, I do need to point out that I have a bias against policy, which I discovered when I was working as the records officer at the National Institutes of Health. Because I discovered, even though I had always thought of myself as on the intellectual side of things, discovered I really liked accomplishing things in the real world. And when I looked at my colleagues in the Division of Management Policy, their idea of accomplishment was we can issue a policy document and that tells everybody what they should be doing. And I found that in the records management field, we could issue guidance and assistance to actually help people achieve their mission better than they could without us, and that was a great feeling of satisfaction. So I tend to regard policy as something that helps people to do things that need to be done or that they want to do rather than something that directs people, and I'll say more about that later.
Thank you very much. Now, what I would really like to do very quickly is find out a little bit more about sort of the demographics and the composition of you folks, trying to get an understanding of how many people sort of are here from different areas. So if you could just do sort of a quick show of hands, how many people are here either affiliated with the federal government or from a federal government agency? That's probably a good third of the audience. What about state government agencies? Okay, 2, 4, 6, 8, 7. Local government agencies? Okay, so state and local are about the same as the federal. What about university records management personnel? Okay, and university students or researchers? And is there anybody here that's actually from private business records management personnel? Woohoo! Okay, so we do have a combination of a variety of different people. Definitely looks like it's most heavily oriented on federal, federal, state, and local government, and university records management and personnel. So that's good, because I'm hoping that will lead to some very fruitful conversation among us all. The way that we see the rest of this session going is basically, I have a series of very few questions because of our time limits that I'm going to pose to each panelist, who's going to probably talk about 5 minutes or so to answer from their perspective. It might be a little more, maybe a little less. They will also then be leading discussions with the other panelists and with you to try to flesh out further information, either getting understanding of the experience of the other panelists and of you folks, or understanding further questions that you might have. And during this all, I will be taking notes on all the responses, and at the end of this, I'll provide a recap of how these responses will be made publicly available to you folks at the end of the session. So question number one. Jim, what are the key policy challenges that you have found within your own professional settings with regards to archives and records management activities, and what kinds of techniques have you had to develop to handle them?
I think currently in today's world within government, especially at the state level, it may be different at the state or local, although I doubt at the local. The biggest thing that's impacting us currently is the budget, of course. And so it's overriding all sorts of policy concerns. The notion that the state archives is going to send out initiatives to say, well, now you must do this or this or this with your electronic records isn't always practical. If there's additional expenses, we're instantly going to get feedback. The budget agency is going to say, no, you can't do that. How are you going to offset the costs? Look for ways to save money. Are there cost efficiencies in doing this? So the parameters around which we are trying to establish policies have shifted from what we call probably good government to how do you save every dime you can. And there's a difference in those two approaches. So we have that problem to deal with. Currently about, I would say, on average over the last 2 years, probably 20% of the states, or I'm sorry, there's been a 20% decline in state archives funding on average across the country. Some have been 50%, and some have probably been 5 or 10%, but there's been dramatic cuts, which impacts directly what we can do and who we have left to do it. The next big issue floating out there, of course, is the relationship and the conversations between the electronic records people at the archives, if you have them, or have them still, and the IT people. In Indiana, where I come from, we have a centralized IT statewide shop. So they've taken all the IT people across state government, and this is, again, a potential cost-cutting measure that they implemented probably 4 years ago, pulling everybody together. So the state archives doesn't really have IT experts. And later we'll discuss a little bit about our needs, and that's one that we probably do have. So we talk about things, and our views are from two different perspectives. The state archives perspective, of course, is how do I preserve this? These are things that, even though they're emails, they need to be kept for more than 6 years. Our IT people said, well, we've bought this new archiving system, and we're going to set it so that all the emails are saved 6 years, and we're going to save space, and then they'll all get deleted. Well, that was all without having a conversation with us, of course. And so we explained, no, it's based on content. Well, then we go back to, well, who's going to take care of all that? So it rolls right into the next issue related to policy, which is education. The biggest issue facing the archives, at least in our state, in our community, is making sure that the end user, because they now drive the entire retention process with electronic records, the end user understands and is educated on what must occur with different types of electronic records. Because your retention schedules, in the case of Indiana, aren't going to reach the 30,000 state employees. They are not going to look to see which bucket should I drop that email in. So we have a huge education issue, which is really the core of our mission. We've gone, roll back the clock 40 years ago, and everyone had file clerks, and there were secretaries who were doing that work for you. Then we moved to computers, and so it was going to be so much easier, and the file clerks disappear. Well, now we're realizing, wait a second, somebody needs to be managing that record, and so now it's the individual, because they're the ones left. So as I see it from my perspective, I think those are the big issues that are facing us at a kind of a global archival level. I'll tell you another key from my perspective is at a high level within the archives, you need to develop your networks within government. You need to be friends with the budget agency. You need to be friends with the policy people, in our case, the governor's office. You need to have those relationships so that they understand the issues you're facing. And also, obviously, to the IT people. You need to break down those barriers because, you're looking at things from different perspectives. And I think everyone, you hear politicians from the President of the United States, pointing to you, down to local mayors talking about the importance of open access. Everyone wants to make sure the information is available, but I don't think they fully understand the complexities of getting you there and the costs involved with making that available. So I'd be interested to hear what my colleagues have to say. Shannon, you want to start?
Sure, absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree with everything that Jim has laid out. Budget concerns are killing us right now. I'm sure it's killing all of you. The state of North Carolina, I was mentioning to Jim earlier, our governor issued an edict that all emails produced by executive branch agencies had to be saved for 10 years due to an issue with our previous governor instructing people to delete emails, which were part of the public record. There was no thought put around that. The cost to the taxpayer was never considered. There was no budget given to that. So you can imagine the challenge of saving all of that information for 10 years. And then you run into the issue of what if it was something that should be saved in perpetuity? What's going to happen in that point? So I certainly agree. The budget is a big problem. We're facing a $3 billion deficit next year. And I've heard from the IT professionals that state this is going to cost about $15 million. To archive 10 years worth of emails for all state employees. So we've got a real challenge. I don't know how it's going to happen, and the legislature did not appropriate any money to that this year. So the education is really important. I think part of the conversation, and you hit right on the head of, and you didn't call it getting a seat at the table, but you're talking about having this network, which enables you to get a seat at the table. Beyond that, it's about effective communication. How do you sell your idea? Right? Why is retention important? What does it mean to an organization to retain? Transparency and openness of government is the buzzword to sell with right now if you're in the business that all of you are in. You talk about that, elected officials pay attention. And you've got to make this sexy, if you will, for them. That's the only way that you're going to get that seat at the table. So I think that's really important. I think everything you said is absolutely happening at the local level, and the pain at the local level and the state level is unreal right now.
Okay. Well, as you heard David Ferriero say the other night, budget is a serious matter for NAR at this point, but not as bad as it is in many of the states where we're facing a cut of 10 to 15%. But I think in the policy arena for NAR, or from a perspective of someone in NAR, the bigger concern is the effectiveness of policy, because we're setting policy for other people. Rather than policy that we have to implement ourselves. And within that context, I think one cannot overemphasize not the importance, but the necessity of not only networking, but collaboration. If you want policy to be put into effect, if you want people to do good records management, you don't nearly have to communicate with them, but you have to convince them of your business case and get them to see how their interests are assisted by your interests so that they will help you to achieve your policy goals.
Comments from the audience or parts of your experience or questions? Yes. Would you mind identifying yourself, please?
Curtis Lutz, Navy History and Heritage Commander. And I think part of the problem that we all deal with, we get these wonderful legislative fiats with no money, you paint our existence as FOIA. to me, one of the things that I just find remarkable in the fact that, we're informing people what we can do, what services we can provide, is the shocking level of ignorance of a lot of senior leadership. You know, I was told once by one of the people in my chamber, there's a technological solution for everything. Yeah, but is it the right solution? And that's very difficult to overcome because they think, oh, this will be an easy fix. No, you don't understand what's involved to get to this point. And I'm not really sure how easy that is to overcome for a lot of us. The one great fallback we have from the operational in trying to make sure that lessons are not lost, and unfortunately, it's a trump card most of you can't throw out. What's the cost of blood? That wouldn't usually get people's attention. But, you know, I'm not sure what we need to do. And what are our options on doing this? Like you said, you know, you make your business case, and sometimes even that just goes right past it. And it's very, I'm sure there's a lot of people who have got that same frustration.
Just a comment to that, and I agree with you. The comment was you make the business case, you educate them, they're still ignorant, refuse education. We deal with that. Everybody on this panel, everybody in this room deals with that on a regular basis. I will tell you, sometimes your business case is not the way that it's not written correctly. You're writing it from an area of expertise that you bring to the table. This is something that I require my students in the CIO programs to do, is write a business case, and then I redline it, which is, of course, what every professor mm-hmm. likes to do, because they write things like gooey. Well, gooey to an elected official is a brownie, right? It's not graphic user interface. It's not the same experience for them. So your business case has got to be the right business case, and I think Ken hit on this. He didn't call it this because he's much more eloquent than I am, but I call it the Whiffam effect. What's in it for me? If you can tell me what's in it for me, then I might play with you. If you can't tell me what's in it for me, and I do this on a regular basis, I educate the elected officials in North Carolina about public records law. And I explain to them, if you use your Yahoo account to conduct government business, it is still a public record. So why do you want that burden on you? Why don't you just use the town account and let the burden be on the town instead of you to retain that record? And eventually, they figure out, boy, if I got into litigation, do I really want somebody going into my Yahoo account and getting access to potentially everything? Let them worry about the town instead. So I don't know if you have comments to add to that.
Yeah, and actually, one of the things I like to quote, in our research program, we have access to really world-class computer scientists and engineers. And one of the smartest of them said to me one day, you know, Ken, you cannot give us a problem that we can't come up with a solution for. What we cannot do is know whether the solution's any good, because we don't have the subject area expertise. You're the people with that. And I've encountered, you know, as high as Navy admirals who say, oh, I don't have time for records management, I can't afford it. When we run out of space, I just buy more servers. But at that point, you have to be ready with why that's not a solution, why, in fact, over time, that's more expensive and still doesn't solve the problem.
Do we have any other questions or comments that you'd like to add to that? Well, let's move on to our next question. Shannon, you have a lot of experience with educating people from going out into many different places in government. What skill sets would aid the individuals within organizations in doing a better job at integrating their ability to navigate organizational policy management and their records management activities? And how do these skill sets vary between the different levels of positions? So from entry level all the way up.
Okay. So let me say this, and I might have disagreement from those of you in the audience and from my panel, so if you disagree with me, you can certainly jump in right away. In this current economy, and given the nature of the workforce, that's the real changing demographics of our workforce, we know that basically for every two people that leave the federal government, there's only one person to replace them from a population standpoint. We've got a real problem from a population standpoint. That coupled with the budgetary constraints that we're all facing at the federal level all the way down, you cannot be a specialist anymore. Your responsibility is to be a generalist who can act like a specialist. So the idea that you need a specific set of skills to come into a job, I would argue that skill set is a really broad skill set. We've already talked about communication. An effective communicator is the most important hire you can make. Somebody who can communicate orally and written in a way that they can talk to a prince or a pauper and make them feel equal, and that sort of model that most of our parents probably put us into. We've got to make sure that we're doing that in our education of these folks, but also in our hiring. You need people who are logical and analytical. I talk to really high-level CIOs from the private sector on a fairly regular basis, and I listen to them because I think that they know a little more about how to hire people than I do. And what they've told me over the last 3 years is, I want somebody who can talk, who can write, who can walk and chew gum at the same time, which is a novel skill set, especially with IT people. No offense to anybody who's an IT person. I mean, I consider myself one of those. I want somebody who is analytical and logical. I can give them all the technical training they'll ever need. I don't want them coming in with every level of certification through Cisco or Microsoft. I want them to be able to be trained, and that education opportunity will emerge for them. So what I've started doing, and I actually teach our graduate class, we call it the Strategic Information Technology Management class. I've changed the name of it because I have listened to my colleagues who are in the audience, Helen and Cal and Lori, and they've said it's not about information technology, right? Because you already said there's a technological fix for everything. It's about information and information management. So we've changed the name of that class this year. Unfortunately, I didn't prepare this on a slide, although I really should have done this. This is something that I use. I know you can't see it, but it's my new chart to teach by. Yes, I will read it to you. But just imagine, like all good academics, I have to have, you know, a matrix of some sort. But my matrix in the center has got investment, which you could read as a project. And the things that I tell my students that they have to have when they walk out the door, and I don't care if you're talking about somebody going to be a manager, somebody going to be an archivist, or somebody going to be an IT person, they've got to have a level of technical proficiency. They don't need to be experts, but they have to be proficient. More importantly, they have to have management skills. They need to know how to manage. Then on this side, I can't read upside down, but I believe that says legal and regulatory. My concern for all of us is that we don't do legal and regulatory training. Everybody should be getting this type of training. You need to know what metadata is. Everybody in this audience knows how to define metadata, correct? Somebody yell the definition to me. I love that. Data about data. Have you ever said that to an elected official or an attorney? They go, huh? And I said, data about data. And then they go, what does that mean? And we actually had a session on this not too terribly long ago. And I had a bunch of elected officials that were sitting around, and they go, well, my records retention is that I print all my emails and put them in a file. And up until recently, we probably would have told them that's okay. That's a low-cost way to manage your records, right? Does that make sense to everybody? Everybody knows that there are at least 4 court cases across this country that say metadata is part of the public record. You guys probably already had training on that. I'm sure you're much more attuned to this than I am. So now I've got IT people telling me, what do I do about metadata? How do I save it? How do I record it? These guys are printing out their emails. They don't know how to capture the metadata associated with an email into Notepad and then print that alongside the document, right? So we're putting all sorts of complicated things. That's where this regulatory and legal piece comes in. And the other piece is they've got to understand policies and procedures, and how you deal with policies and procedures. This is the problem that I think we face at the federal level, at the state level, and at the local level. We're really good at writing policy, and I love that you're biased against policy because I think that's fabulous. We're really good at writing policy that is just stupid. That I should probably, whoever's recording this, can you edit that comment? Because we write policies that put unrealistic timelines and schedules around information. And I love my colleagues at the Department of Cultural Resources that write the records retention policy for North Carolina. They are brilliant and wonderful and so talented. And then I work with the IT people who have 138 pages for a municipal retention schedule that they've got to figure out how to deal with from an IT side. And I actually have a great example of this. I was meeting with the group of attorneys. We train all the attorneys in North Carolina from a local government standpoint. And they said to me, I don't understand why IT people can't just fix this problem and just make sure that we save stuff as long as it's supposed to be saved. And then the minute it's not supposed to be saved anymore, because this is what attorneys think, delete it. Because if you delete it, then when there's litigation or a records request and you are allowed to delete it, you don't have to produce it. So you got to delete it the instant it can be deleted. all attorneys will tell you this. And it makes sense, and it's also a cost associated with that. And I said, let me just explain the situation in Greenville, North Carolina. We have an email system that could do that for you. It's not hard, right? You set up a system where you put folders in. Those folders have rules on the back end from an IT standpoint. I drill it down like dummy level because that's the level that I tend to operate at technologically. So I'm like, I couldn't even operate an iPad like Jim has up here. And so I say, we've got all these rules on the back end that tell you this is the day it came in. This is the kind of content. The user has to decide how long that content is supposed to be kept according to those rules that the Department of Cultural Resources has set. And they will go through and they will drag them into the buckets, the folders. And the folder will know to delete it the day it's due to be deleted, based on what the user set up. They got through 58 folders. And they weren't even a third of the way through the retention schedule. What user can manage 58? I can't even manage 4 folders for the most part. Nobody's going to do that kind of work. So it's really a challenge. We've got to make policies that make sense for our folks. Other skills that they have to bring to the table, and I harp on this, and I feel bad about harping on this because I guess should have been in the private sector, except that I love the public sector. You've got to learn how to sell. If you can't sell, you really don't exist. So learning how to effectively sell something is really important. I do very embarrassing things to my students, like make them learn how to build and sell an egg catcher device. I did have somebody break my arm during class last month trying to do that, so I would not recommend coming to my class and learning how to sell an egg catcher device. But we've got to make sure that these folks are coming to the table knowing how to sell, and that's really about effective communication. You get 3 minutes with an elected official, if you're lucky. Their attention span is very short. You've got to tell them what's in it for them, you've got to tell them why it matters, and it can't be because it's the right thing to do or our law says so. They really don't care so much about that, at least the ones that I work with. A couple of other things. You need to know how to do risk assessment. You need to know how to do project management. The best project managers I know get put on all sorts of really cool projects, like building town halls when they're an IT person. I actually have a CIO who was in charge of the project management around a town hall because he was so good at that job of project management. You've got to have enterprise thinking. So what's the holistic view of this policy? And those are really interesting skill sets to work with our students. I think that the students that I've seen come through the ESOPI program, that's been an area that they've really excelled. And thinking about Emily Roscoe, and I deal specifically with our students that are going on to the SILS side this year, but it's really been interesting to watch them. I'm sure you worked with Kate this year, and she probably had that sort of holistic view of how things are happening. I think we're lucky, I will tell you, because these younger folks, and some of you are in the audience, those of you who were born back when technology existed when you were born, instead of those of us who went to college without ever using the internet, like me, these kind of devices make them think holistically. They don't question these sort of silos that we as government officials like to operate in. So we're going to have to change the way that we do our job, and we really need to listen to the folks that are coming into our organizations. I think it's important. I think when you get, so that's across the board, but if I was thinking about entry-level folks, that would certainly be where I would focus. Middle management, same skill set. Senior management, the only difference with senior management is they've got to figure out how to translate. You've got to know enough as a senior manager, especially a CIO or CTO, to translate between the techies that you're hiring because they're techies and the archivist who need a whole different set of tools and techniques and have a whole different set of legal requirements on them, and the elected officials and managers who also have a different set of demands. So being that translator is a really important skill set for the folks that are at that top level. Anybody want to chime in?
Sure. I want to challenge one thing.
So okay, please. Barely. I figured this would happen.
As far as the general, I think from my perspective, running a state archives, I really am looking for people now who would have a good, solid understanding of electronic records, of how data elements are,
absolutely,
what maps them out, how to figure out the core structures of the data, because we're going to have to figure out. Earlier this week, there was a conversation about whether or not we just take in everything that's electronic and save it all, or whether we try to get it into systematic format, similar formats, so that we will have a way to access it 200 years from now. So we've got to get people who really have the quality technical skills coming into the archives, because my staff doesn't have it now. And so from that technology standpoint, it's key that we're hiring, I won't say young, that'd be terrible to say, but people who have current technology standards and understanding?
I would wholeheartedly agree with you. I don't think we're going to disagree at all on that. So when I said generalists, I meant that they can do that piece. They also understand the archivist role. So I think this is where we've seen probably the most interesting thing about this project that we've worked on is we were training a certain way at the School of Government. SILS was training a certain way at the School of Information and Library Science. And when those two got together, it was like, aha, this actually starts making sense. It doesn't mean we don't need both skill sets. It means we need both skill sets in the same human being instead of in two different human beings that don't operate together. I think that I wholeheartedly agree with you.
And before I let Ken talk, I just want to say one thing. This is something, an exercise that we went through. You'd mentioned retention schedules. And so in Indiana, what we've done is we reduced the number of retention schedules by half, which is a massive process because we had over 12,000 retention schedules in Indiana. We're now in the 5,000s. And that's still a massive number. But it's critical because, again, you have end users who are going to have to figure out what am I supposed to do with this. And there's no way. We had agencies, the social service agency in Indiana had over 1,600 retention schedules, a record series. They're never going to figure out what to do. So you've got to simplify the processes for them from an administrative policy standpoint. Simplify all that so that when they actually have employees who have to figure things out, they have a handful of choices like you mentioned. So that's something you as administrators or archivists could be working toward.
Okay, so I'm going to extend the disagreement, non-disagreement, in a couple of dimensions.
I'm always polarizing.
I certainly agree with the importance of communication skills. In fact, I think if you want to be effective these days, you have to have the gift of tongues. Not to speak multiple languages, but to be able to speak multiple idioms and to always speak on the empirical level rather than the abstract level. We're fortunate that there are actually two of us from the National Archives who are on the Interagency Working Group on Digital Data. And in the early days, we were able to use the good cop, bad cop routine. And the bad cop was the one who came in and started talking about, you know, under any reasonable interpretation of the Federal Records Act, scientific data that's under the control of the federal agency are federal records. And, of course, as soon as you say something like that, warfare breaks out. And essentially, you've lost your audience. So we tried that and had the predictable effect, and then the other one of us never used the word records, never mentioned that there is a law that governs these things, but just started talking in a sustained fashion month after month about good things that come from managing information, recognizing that there's a temporal dimension to that management, and gradually exposing the other people on the working group to the fact that we have a lot of insights that they don't have because we're exercising a profession that focuses on information and focuses on information over the long term. We have found that extremely useful for us in developing a very good relationship with the Executive Office of the President, because what distinguishes the National Archives on these interagency groups from other agencies is they're worried about their specific mission. We, given our mission, have to worry about the whole of government. So we have that in common with the White House. And even though we're a very small player, they see us as an important ally. But so it's, you know, talk the language of the people you're talking with. Talk about things that they will appreciate, like how does a good plan for managing the life cycle of scientific data help them to promote the reuse that's important? And also recognizing their concerns. The area where I'll start disagreement is I think salesmanship is very important, but I think you need to take it to another level and have really good negotiating skills, because you sell somebody something, they've got it, and you walk away. You negotiate with them. What the end result of that is an agreement, hopefully on an agreement on their side that they're going to do what you want them to do, which is good records management, an agreement on your side that you're going to help them do that. You're going to make it as easy for them, and you'll help them in battles that they might run into. So the negotiation leads to an ongoing commitment of both sides. I tend to look at any management situation I'm in as a negotiation, whether it's dealing with a policy issue or doing a performance review for one of my staff, because you always need to be aware of the two sides of that. I will also disagree about technical expertise. I don't think archivists or records managers should try to be technical experts. I think they need a good grounding in information technology and networking technology, But what I emphasize when I'm talking to students and young people in our profession is you need to be able to exercise technical judgment. You need to be able to figure out, you know, even though this technology looks really great, is it really the best technology for the particular situation in which you need to use it? Technical judgment is not technical expertise. It's not knowing how to do anything with the technology. It's being able to recognize what the technology could do for an organization or for an individual.
I agree, and I would like to be as eloquent as Ken is one day, just for the record. I like that negotiation. I'm going to write that down, so the next time I teach my class, I talk about that.
I learned that in negotiation class.
Yeah, no, I really like that. But one thing, and you've got it written down here, and you, I don't think you've said this word yet. Can you say that word just real quickly?
I'd love to say that word, yeah. The word is credibility.
I think it's really important. One of the things that Ken just said, I'm going to stretch just a little bit further. It's technical judgment. It's also right-sizing is what I call it. So who in here knows SMARSH? S-M-A-R-S-H. It's a technology that's out there. It's a tool you can buy. It's an e-discovery tool, basically. So I was in a local government not too long ago, and they said, oh, we bought SMARSH because it's going to archive all of our social media for us, which it does. And it does very, very well. It's a very expensive for a local government product. And I said, did you look at this option, and this option that were free? And they said, no. Part of this whole process is not selling them, which I like the negotiating part. It's not necessarily giving them the best and the biggest, the end-all, be-all that does everything for everyone. It's what's the right thing for that audience at that time. So it's really about right-sizing, and you have to be fairly technically judgmental, right? Knowledgeable, not about the data inside it or how it works or writing code, but how do you actually make the best decision to right size? Because that gives you the credibility you need. And that's really important. Never overselling and never underselling, but giving them exactly what they need from a right sizing standpoint. You can add to credibility since you wrote the word.
My point with the credibility was that you want to make sure that you're recognized within your association or organizations as one of the experts in the area. So, you know, the technology piece isn't really our focus, but it's going to be. It's becoming that way. And so you just want to have the credibility within your organization to actually speak the language and be able to talk to policy decision makers, whatever level that is, with them believing what you're telling them is a credible, and you are credible because you are making good decisions. I think that's where I was trying to head with the comment.
Absolutely.
And I have to agree with that. In fact, the entire 35 years I've been in this area has been concentrating on electronic records. Wow. You can't do that if they can show you up as ignorant of technology.
Questions or comments from the audience about that particular topic? They're going to disagree, too, I can just tell. Can I start with her, and then I'll come to the lady in red?
Working in the state archives and working with agencies of different sizes, often it is the archivist or the person who's out there helping with records management that even in small agencies has to translate between an IT person and a business person in their agency about what they're trying to accomplish and what the concerns are. So it really depends on what level of agencies you call on, and oftentimes it's the archivist, the person from the state archive, the records management program, that has to be the translator between the IT person and trying to talk about, okay, what elements do you need to get from the system? Because a lot of IT people can't talk to the rest of them.
They can't. You're right. They're very interesting. Well, they picked a profession that kept them in the basement, quite frankly, right? They wanted to be people who did card punches, and that's their personality, and there's nothing wrong with that personality. It's just that they tend to have challenges in certain areas. But in a loving way, I say that, and please edit that again from the record. But I do, what the lady in the back said, if you couldn't hear, is that it depends on the level of the agency that you're working with. The archivist might be the translator between the business side of the house and the IT side of the house. I was involved in a really interesting project recently around metadata, unfortunately, trying to define it and deal with it. And there was a lawyer from the governor's office, there was the archivist, and then there was myself and another lawyer that I work with, all looking at a document. And we went round and round and round on the document because archivists use very specific language and definitions around metadata that is not consistent with what the court uses in any of the court cases, right? The substantive, now I'm not saying the court has defined it correctly. Please recognize that is, the court had no business defining it, but they defined it for you and they defined it incorrectly. And so the records retention policy was really interesting around metadata because we couldn't get the attorneys who were interpreting one way and the archivists who were interpreting it in their classically trained way to agree on anything. And so I was like in the middle going, wait, no, don't fight about this. This is what you really mean. But there has to be somebody with some level of ability to negotiate. So now you're not just negotiating with IT people, you're negotiating with attorneys. And that, I think I'm going to hire Ken for from now on. and then the lady. And absolutely. I tell everybody that I'm the IT evangelist, but I might become the televangelist now. I really like that. I doubt it. I work with local governments. Yes, sir.
I want to disagree with that to a certain point. I absolutely agree communications are important, but having listened to many people talk about new records over the years, and what things like hearing a sell, the televangelist, at some point they don't buy. No matter how good you are a seller, not everybody buys. And in fact, one of the things I've seen is frequently people aren't buying. And I think we need to look at if people aren't buying while they're selling, we have an obligation to look at the product because we may be selling something effective. And I think sometimes people are so stuck on the way we've done things and the concerns we have that we've got to change what we're selling. That they're never going to buy. And so, yes, communication is good, evangelism is good, but we also have to get to that point of self-reflection to say, maybe we need to change our product. And we're at that point where we have to do it ourselves. There's limits to self.
I think that that's actually a really good point. I have a slide that I use when I teach classes, and it says, how do we use technology? Now, remember, I'm talking to IT people to do, within these sort of constraints, to create public value first and foremost. Because if they can't answer that question for me, they shouldn't be doing it in my world. And the second one is where a better division of labor is required. The third one is where innovation is absolutely essential. You're right. We cannot solve our problems today using the same level of thinking that we had when we created the problems. And, you know, Albert Einstein figured that out. He's actually the one who made that quote. So we know this. Unfortunately, we have failed to learn from our lessons, as the gentleman in the fourth row said. But I think you're absolutely right. We've got to innovate. And then we know implementation is really difficult. So we've got to hit a home run at some level. But I think you're absolutely right. And that's where we were talking about the younger people coming into our organization. Sometimes we need to listen to them. And sometimes we need to listen to the people who've been in our organizations for a long time, who've seen all the brokenness. I mean, we've really got a problem where, especially in government, we are wedded to whatever we have jumped in with, and we never, ever want to change, especially if it's going to cost anything to change, right? Never mind that it might save you $20 million in the long run. We're going to build a $5 million scaffold to keep that $45 million investment running, which is insane.
I think sort of on the flip side, and this was just touched on very briefly, but is that both listening and almost a sort of ethnographic knowledge of your organization and really sort of understanding what is the drivers within the organization. Because if you're going to be a good cop, you have to know what people are going to respond to positively. You know, sort of know the audience and you know, understanding why aren't people buying. Part of that is knowing why they're not buying and what is, you know, what is driving their choices and what is driving their fears. Things like that. So to me, it's sort of like that flip side of the selling and the talking is the listening.
I wholeheartedly agree with you. I think everybody on this panel would. I honestly think y'all could just be teaching this session, at least my part. So we'll get to Ken next, and then we'll all take notes.
Okay, we actually have a two-parter question for Ken, and I think that he's actually been very proactive and has prepared in advance some good comments. First part of this question is, if you were hiring someone from graduate school who would have to quickly come up to speed with policy, environment, and record-keeping needs of an organization, what would be the qualities you'd look for in such a person, and what types of skills would you expect him or to have learned in graduate school? And then the second part is, what if you were to send a relatively high-level administrator to a certificate program to enable him or her to better address policy and record-keeping requirements, and what types of short courses might you want him or her to attend? So if you could go ahead and help us out with that.
There are enough of you in the audience who know I'm extremely visually oriented, so I need visual props to remind me what it is I want to say. So if I'm hiring someone into a policy position or to play the policy game, the thing that's most important to me is, can they win it? You don't get into this game unless you really want to win the policy game. So on the left, you find the student, fresh out of school, is trying to figure out how to play this game, and on the other side, they're up against some old-timers who, if they've been in the bureaucracy for a while, know the rules very well, but pick and choose when they decide to abide by those rules. My experience in four decades in government is the predominant view of what policy is like is you start out with some authority, like the Federal Records Act. Okay, this is a law, this is what you've got to do, but the law is at too high a level of abstraction, so what policy does is boil that down into some directions that people can implement, and then what the hoi polloi needs to do is just conform with the policy you set out. Well, the effects of that show up in a variety of ways, and here's some quotes from the Government Accountability Office. Records management has received low priority within the federal government. Prior reports have identified persistent weaknesses, including a lack of policies and training. Almost 80% of agencies were at moderate or high risk of improper disposition. I'll make these slides available, so I'm not going to read all of it, but look at the one at the bottom. Oversight of records management has not been effective, and records management historically has been afforded limited resources and inadequate management attention, not just currently, but historically. Well, the interesting thing of these quotes are, you know, they're almost, the three of them say the same thing. One of them was from a report from GAO issued just a couple months ago. The other two are from a report it issued in 1981. Things have really not changed much. In fact, it's even worse than that. Back in 1981, the title of that report was Federal Records Management, A History of Neglect. They could still use that title today. And they pointed out in 1981 that the problem had been there since the passage of the Federal Records Act 30 years previous. Now, if you've got policy that's been around for 60 years and it's still regarded as essentially ineffective, you've got a fundamental management problem. And if you want to deal with that, you need a different approach than the canonical one I just showed you. And I think someone who wants to work in the policy area then needs to be able to conceive of policy as something that mediates between goals and reality and needs to be able to take a step back and see the big picture. So we start out again with the same authority, which usually entails some responsibility, and then we articulate what are the goals we want to achieve given that responsibility. And from those goals, we can derive policies, and the policies should aim at specific effects that are measurable and verifiable in the real world. Another skill you will need is the ability to come into a terrain. I'm jumping ahead of myself. One of the problems is if this is still a top-down approach, and if that's your whole basis for articulating policy, it's insufficient, and you're never going to get to real-world effects. So you need an additional skill, which is the ability to step forward and figure out what really is in the terrain, including who are the other players. You have to gather facts about what are their strengths, what are their weaknesses, what are their interests, can you get them to play the game you want them to play, and so on. That will help make your policy more substantial. It should also influence your view of what the goals should be, because the goals should be defined with respect to the status quo, not just with respect to some idealized authority. So that will help you come up with a little more flesh. In addition, you need skill in collaboration, because if you want people to conform to policy or to implement policy, you need to know what is in their self-interest. The best way to get someone to follow a policy is to show them how it's in their own interest to do that. And so I think we need to engage people in collaboration, not only in setting goals, but also in determining what the policy should be. And with these, should have enough information to really figure out what are some effects that are verifiable ideally even measurable in the real world to see whether you've achieved your policy goals. You also, I've already jumped ahead of myself. So verifiable outcomes, measurable outcomes, if you can do it. You need to look at very much your positioning and where is your strength and who's working with you. And also you need the ability to enlist allies in your struggle. So look for other influential players who might have concerns or interests that could be aligned with yours, and find out ways that that you can tap into their goodwill and their collaboration. So again, these negotiation skills are very important. Also recognize that policy is not simply a document that you issue. That policy is a means to an end, meaning the goals you want to achieve, and that as the situation on the ground changes and as your position changes, the policy needs to be revisited, the goals need to be restated, and even you need to shift the effects as the situation on the ground changes. Bottom line in all of this is you can't win the policy game as a one-sided game. It has to be seen as a multi-party game in which you're engaging all the players, both people who are opposed to you and people who could be allies to you, and people who could switch sides depending on circumstances. Those are my view of the high-level skill sets that contribute, that a student should bring or be able to quickly to acquire in addressing the policy area.
Any comments or questions on that?
Your illustration shows a game board that has set rules and players that play by those rules. In the real world, there are those who ignore the rules that exist for various reasons. How do you handle this?
Absolutely, and that's why I chose the photograph with the cat to begin with. And in fact, what I've observed over the years is there are a variety of ways that federal agencies conform to policy. Some of them are, obviously times when agencies just ignore policies and don't do what they should do. There are other times when they conform pro forma. And it's very easy to do that. Oh, we have to have a records management program. I hire a records manager. And the records manager issues record schedules. They do the things that a records manager is competent to do, but I don't really give them resources. And I don't give them the clout to make sure that the record schedule is influenced. And that's what, GAO has been finding for the last 60 years in the case of the federal government. There are others that I've seen that I have to really admire, and it's what I call vacuous compliance. You act in a way so that you can be seen to be fully in compliance with the policy, but you do it so that you really don't change anything that's important to you. And there's certainly a lot of people in government who are highly skilled at doing that. And that's one of the reasons why I was introducing multiple games. When we think of policy, we think of order, like the chessboard. But you're absolutely right. We're dealing with a very disorderly world, even in government, which should be more orderly than elsewhere. And you need to size up the players you're dealing with. And it's one of the reasons I was saying policy needs to be seen as an iterative process where you see, are they actually complying? Are they resisting? If they're resisting, do they have good reasons for it? You may be asking something that either they can't do or that would go against other important interests. And if you're not willing to take that feedback and revise your policy to give them something they could actually do, you're shooting yourself in the foot. So love your remark. 100% agreement with it.
Rick.
I noticed that most of you were all asking questions and responses to the positive sections of this manual, our skills needed and our outside of the strictly archived records management information in the field. And by the way, which I agree with, but the educators that I talk to about this mostly, and there are others, but the other ones you mentioned, such as the ethical issues of dealing with information management, especially with records management. The reaction I get from most educators is, is twofold. One, they either say, look, we've got to get people who really know records management, archives management, as a first product. These other skills that we have in continuing education, the first thing we've got to learn is people who know what they're talking about with respect to technical skills on the archive records management. Or they say that we can't get 10,000 to 5,000 back. We don't have any more hours in the classroom that we can assign all of these peripheral, as greatly needed as they may be, skills. And they raise the issue about whether you're producing students at the entry level, or if you're talking about mid-life or senior level skills, and maybe a totally different course. So I think that this is going to be a particularly difficult task for the SAPI project to undertake. Because I mean, I've seen some of the wonderful courses in SOG school that would meet some of these needs. But I don't know how you're going to stuff them into the same bag with the archives and records skills and not take it more than a couple of years, or a couple of years to get a degree.
Let me make a comment, and then I think I've got two colleagues here who would like to make comments. How many are university faculty in here? Okay, so please don't take offense at what I'm getting ready to say.
We're ready.
You're right. Look, I told you I'm polarizing. We've got to change the way we teach. We all know this. We know that we're not doing a good job preparing our students. And I will tell you this from the School of Government side, because the universities, quite frankly, reward the wrong things. 10 years based on how much money you bring in from a grant standpoint, how much you're publishing. That does not translate in the real world. It's important, and don't hear me as saying it's not important. But we need to be more, we need to challenge ourselves. We don't have enough time, right, to do what we need to do to make our curriculum as robust as possible. I do think we could squeeze it all in. I do think that we need to use more problem-based learning or case-based learning approaches. I think that that's really important. But if the only thing we get rewarded on are how much money we bring, how many articles we produce, how many presentations we give, that's really difficult to change your teaching structure. I mentioned to Laurie that I have been on a non-tenure track for the last 10 years of my career because I didn't want to deal with that stuff. I made a decision to change, which I may regret, and I recognize that, but because the rules of the game are just not in favor of our students, in my opinion. Now, that's just my opinion. So please don't get mad at me if you're a faculty member. And I think that our tenured faculty are facing the same constraints. Even though we think you're free when you get tenure, you're still not really free to do that kind of really robust revamping. And the university is immensely guilty, especially the large universities, of silo-based thinking. The fact that these two departments are working together, are we the first in the country to do this kind of dual degree between the public administration and School of Information and Library Science, that is unacceptable. It really is. We need to figure out how to solve these problems. And we preach collaboration all day long, but we don't even practice it in our own universities. So now my colleagues who raised their hands can certainly talk, and I'm sure I'll probably get thrown at.
Well, as a woman who always brings lots of luggage wherever she goes, we made the bag bigger because we took 2 degrees together. So we made, there's a bit of a savings, there's a 20% savings and overlap from the student's perspective so that they have a buy-in to pay for the degree.
Okay.
But we decided we didn't have time in our curriculum to teach policy or particularly their expertise. So you all are doing that. And we're doing things that you don't do. So,
okay.
It's a bigger bag for that, but the bag can only get so big, you're right. And that, and no matter how big the little bag is, the teaching and the, I don't think it's the talking, I don't think it's the discussion, but any of that, I think it's, coming up with really good exercises for the students to do that we really need to work in. Yeah. I think that's full process.
And I will say the SILS folks do a really nice job in North Carolina because they bring in practitioners. That's the other piece that we miss. We need to be relying on all of you that are sitting in this audience. I would call y'all y'all because I'm from North Carolina. So we need to rely on y'all to come in and teach our folks what they need to know. And we don't do a good job of that in the academic world. Y'all do. We don't as an academic.
But ALA, who credits our school,
mm-hmm.
Says, oh, you shouldn't do too much of that. Right?
It's unfortunate.
You need to have people being taught by real faculty.
Right.
So there's a big tension on that.
Yes.
And we're still guilty.
And the reality is there's no money for training when you get mid-career. Does anybody in here have much of a training budget right now?
No.
Right? That's the first thing that's cut. So this idea that they're going to get it later, I'm a little concerned about because we don't expect the economy to ever look like it used to look. Cal, did you have something? No? Other colleagues who? Oh, there's somebody. I can't.
Go ahead.
Came out of grad school within the last 5 years, I think it's sort of it's hopeful, I think, that faculty are here and saying, oh, we're going to change your thing, but I think there needs to be two sort of outreach to the administration and to talk about, well, this is the thing, these are the kind of things you need to emphasize. During my training, we had one management course, it was a generalized management course. Nobody took it seriously. There was a policy course, which was optional, and then this was not an emphasis on the sort of soft skills that I find myself having to use in my profession every day. And so I think there was need to be that sort of teaching.
And it's not just in the archivist field, just so you know. I mean, the IT field is horrible at this. They come in and they don't know how to even, they've never written a business case when they come to my class, and they are CIOs at this point and have never had to write a business case. And that's a real shame. Yes, ma'am.
I have found myself in 10 years of management in archives really lamenting that my staff did not have these soft skills. They don't come out of graduate school with it. The practical engagement or internships that seems to help if we as mentors shape projects that students can see from beginning to end and help them understand how to do it. I also sent one of my staff to the ASLH project management workshop. It was phenomenal. It was 2.5 days, it was very reasonably priced, and either we should be sending our kids to that or do something through SAA and our various organizations that we can offer some of these soft skills professional development. We really need it as a profession.
One of the follow-up on that, there's a model I think would be good for the SAA to consider. In the Digital Library Federation, they have two forums a year rather than one conference. The members of the Federation who come to the meetings are basically the directors of libraries for the major universities, and it's now worldwide. But the forums are designed for the people who do the real work. And the idea is that gives them a chance to meet with their peers. And within that, the library directors have encouraged formation of peer groups. There's now a whole coterie within the employees of the libraries that are members of this who have a project management group, and they share with each other knowledge about project management, what tools work for what purpose, what's not good. And, that's something I think maybe our professional society could think about. It. Maybe you'd like to propose a session about that for next year's conference.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
In fact, the Society of American Archivists has begun looking at that because they have the Archival Leadership Institute, in which they bring in mid-level archivists, and it's a week of training about dealing with the press, dealing with the budget, doing those types of things. So I think there is at least the beginning recognition of that, and it needs to be increased for promotion.
And it's interesting you bring up budget. I mean, that's one area where you become a manager, you've got to know how to do budgeting and finance. How many of us train people to do budgeting and finance in our programs? Do y'all have a class on budgeting and finance?
Okay.
Actually, this lady up here has been very instrumental.
Yeah, it's been incorporated into the electronic records management class. And then I think that Helen has a class that is very, very good that includes a section on grant writing.
Good.
So.
I'll just add that the best students I have are working practitioners who often have 5 to 10 or more years' experience. And I think when you say, you know, bridging the gap between academia and practice people, I think that's being able to have the more experienced students is great, but that requires a commitment on the part of institutions to give them time, give them some funding. I mean, we bring them in to be because of IMLS scholarships. And so, if institutions can find even a small amount of money and time, then that would really help, I think, be educated as well as institutions themselves.
Okay. Any other comments or questions? Well, we have a couple of minutes left, so maybe I have just a couple more minutes to sort of give another push for this ESAPI 21 program, and in particular, our dual degree program. We did hold a symposium last January as well, in which a number of people from primarily local government came and spent a day, and Shannon was there, and our advisory board members, including Rick Berry, was there. He's another one of our advisory board members. And we essentially asked very similar questions. And there were some similarities from what we got from them and what we've heard from you today and what you folks have talked about. And clearly the top need that people put forward were communication skills, the ability to write short, concise, to the point arguments to officials, the ability to engage in oral communications and engage in outreach. And at that point in time, actually, Rick gave a really nice example, because I think a lot of times, especially if you're dealing, in a records management scenario where you may not be in a situation where you can talk to the top-level people who actually have control of the funding, you have to figure out what's the best way to network with people and what's the best kind of contacts to deal with. And when you're trying to make those kind of contacts, they may not be the top-level people, as I'm sure many of you have faced, especially as you started your careers. And Rick gave a really good example of a situation in which he went into a local government, and the records manager was trying, and please correct me if I get any of this wrong, the records manager was trying to start up a records management program, and of course could not get FaceTime with the people that actually made the decisions. And so he had the nice novel approach of going to the facilities manager and talking to the facilities manager and getting to know that person and saying, okay, look, here's the level of records we're dealing with now. Here's how we're going to be dealing with, the number of records we're going to be dealing with over the next few years. What do you think? And from my understanding, the facilities manager was like, oh, no. And the facilities manager had the connections necessary to go talk and was able to, put through a convincing argument. So sometimes that kind of networking, it's easy to come across as if we need to somehow develop networks and contacts with the very highest people, and that's not always very possible. So just being able to find as many contacts as possible in the organization at all different levels can be very, very helpful. Another thing that we found during the symposium was, of course, the ability to, as you mentioned, Shannon, the ability to convince others to value records management activities by knowing who to influence, by engaging in stakeholder building. And one of the things that I know from my own experience, having been a consultant at Deloitte, one of the first things that they taught me was, if you want to find out how to influence other people, you not only need to know what they're interested in, you have to listen to them and listen to the kinds of things they talk about. Some people will talk about their dogs. Some people will talk about their kids. Some people will talk about sports. Find out what's interesting to them and then begin to shape your conversation around those types of activities. Because it's always possible to sort of slip in your conversations in just these general conversations. Another finding that we had was that was very important to have an awareness of national or international initiatives that inform one's professional work. People need to be able to evaluate policy and its implementation. One of our board members specifically said, we need policy engineers. And then another person said they felt that people need to know macro appraisal. So I guess my last question is whether any of you folks on the panel or any of you in the audience would like to add anything else to that. Well, timing is getting pretty okay here. What I've done is I have tried to take copious notes of what everybody has to say here, and I will pull up a report, and it will be available at the ESAPI website that is here. I've also given you my email so that if afterwards you think of anything else that you think is important, please feel free to forward that on to me as well. And I wanted to thank all of you folks for your help and your information. And then my last question would be, Helen and Cal, did you want to add anything further about the ESAPI program or the dual degree program?
Well, the dual degree program is ongoing, and of course, the fellowship has been funded, and maybe you get a course teacher. So if you know folks who would benefit from this sort of dual degree education, send them our way.
Nice. And I do have a number of flyers, so please feel free to come up if you're interested or think you know somebody that might be interested. And there's information here on that program.
Yes, ma'am. She has got a question right here.
I was wondering if anyone here could give us an update on the Archives Leadership Institute. Is that going to continue growing?
It did receive additional funding. I know it's at least one more year, probably two more years. So there'll be a call for applicants later.
Okay, thank you very much. And yes, thank you, IMLS, wherever you are right now. So, okay.